Hey guys, this episode is being brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integration with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, start here, go anywhere. Now on to the episode. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and this week we're talking about movies that illustrate mind-destroying thought experiments, probably without intending to. Some movies are about kind of mind-blowing ideas, and they know the hell out of that fact. Like Interstellar, the characters spend 30 minutes just talking about how crazy physics is. In Contact, the movie based on the novel by Carl Sagan, which I'm convinced actually that Christopher and Jonathan Nolan saw that and loved it when they were younger like me. And then they went and read everything Carl Sagan wrote and were like, wait, why didn't he put all of this in the movie? If we ever become the world's favorite makers of movies, we will do that. We can keep the guy who played the priest in Contact. He was handsome. I like to imagine them saying for some reason, but Contact and Interstellar are both chock full of interesting ideas, and we're talking about neither of them. Instead, we're talking about movies that we've spent so much time watching and thinking about that we noticed some plot holes in them, pretty standard movie fan behavior. But then we went and read books about philosophy and physics until we came up with reasons that those plot holes actually make sense and illustrate ideas that are more incredible than the ones the movie seems to be about, which I'm pretty sure is a symptom of some manner of mental disorder, like borderline personality or whatever personality disorder is determined to bring the world in line with the warped sort of subjective version that exists in its own mind. Narcissistic personality disorder, maybe? I don't know. Everyone's got that one. Narcissism is sort of the HPV of personality disorders, in that 90% of the world supposedly has it. And nobody I've ever met believes they have it. It was a stretched metaphor that actually worked out pretty well, I think. Narcissism and HPV should grab a drink. They have a lot in common. I feel like you guys could use maybe some examples of what the hell we're talking about today. I'll start with my example because it's probably the most confusing and poorly explained in the conversation. So Pulp Fiction. Bet you didn't think Pulp Fiction was about quantum physics. Pulp Fiction came out in the 90s when I was in high school, and I remember people being confused by its sort of non-linear structure, and a peer of mine actually at Lexington Catholic in Kentucky saying it didn't make sense because a guy was dead and then he wasn't. And I don't want to blame that all on Kentucky. I think, you know, it was the 90s, and if you'd never seen a movie that employed nonlinear storytelling and were kind of an idiot, you might think, hey, John Travolta's back from the dead? But I'd always, because of that, just automatically associated any confusion over the timeline kind of instinctually with dumb people. But over the past 7 years at Cracked, we've come up against this idea over and over again that Quentin Tarantino movies are actually exploring this idea of alternate parallel universes. All exploring the same alternate timeline, starting with Inglourious Basterds. We'll talk a little bit about what that alternate timeline is later in the conversation. But when I watched Pulp Fiction for like the 100th time with the idea of parallel universes in mind, I noticed something that broke my brain and made me think that maybe the stupid kid in Kentucky might have been onto something. And to talk about what I noticed and how it fits into quantum physics, we're going to have to talk about sort of this really mindfucky aspect of quantum physics, as I understand it, and a bunch of experiments that seem to suggest that when you look really close at the physical universe, like get down beyond molecules and even atoms, it's stuff that's smaller than atoms, things start to behave in ways that don't make sense at all. One single thing suddenly can exist in two places at once and move in opposite directions at the same time. And ever since Einstein discovered relativity, that was the last big breakthrough in physics, science has been sort of trying to figure out how any of that stuff down at the really small level is even possible. I'll actually mention it actually sort of stopped Einstein in his tracks, this idea that one thing, one noun, could do two verbs in the same moment. And rightly so, because that's impossible based on our understanding of the world and everyone's understanding of the world up to that point. And one explanation that they've come up with in the ensuing decades, reluctantly, is that what we're seeing when we get down to that level is the very beginning of the universe splitting off into alternate dimensions of reality. Instead of choosing one direction, each quark or electron chooses both directions, just like the math says. In one universe, it heads in one direction, and in another universe, it chooses a different direction, and there's a different version of you in both universes that both equally exist. Simplified version of how it works that probably isn't technically correct, but helps me think about the idea is when you buy a lottery ticket and people tell you that there's a 1 in a million chance that you win the lottery, according to rational Newton getting bonked on the head by an apple version of the universe, that just means you bought a ticket and you're probably not going to win. But according to this theory, at the moment, the lottery balls are drawn, a million different dimensions of reality kind of are born into existence, and in 999,999, you lose, and there's one where you actually win the lottery, if it really was exactly a 1 in a million, and all those different strands of reality totally exist side by side. So like 10 years ago, there was a quirk of some significance that spun clockwise, and this version of you that's listening to this podcast moved forward in time down the clockwise path, but there was another version of the quirk that spun counterclockwise at that same exact moment, and a slightly different version of you went down the counterclockwise path, and that version still exists in an alternate parallel universe unless they're dead. And this is happening constantly. Each moment kind of creates a different version of you that branches off. Before each moment, the future is, I think physics describes it as a cloud of probability. And once the moment happens, you are sent hurtling down one path. And sort of a nearly identical version goes hurtling down a different path. And that initial difference is enough to send you off in vastly different directions over the course of time, I guess. So, according to this model, the universe existence is sort of just a single strand of probability you're sliding down as it winds its way through this infinite web of time and space and probability. You happen to be on one of the strands where you still exist after an infinite number of moments that could have gone in any number of directions. So, congratulations, first of all. All of our webs must be just crowded with thousands of dead ends where you stopped existing and died a horrible, painful death. So, all right, that was a lot of explanation, but I do think it'll help you understand what the hell I'm talking about when we start talking about quantum physics and the cat experiment and the machine gun experiment and Pulp Fiction. But it's not all that. We'll talk about The Matrix and The Terminator and just all movies with the singularity, which we rattle off like everyone knows what that is. But among people who are too familiar with sci-fi, the singularity usually refers to the technological singularity, the point at which artificial intelligence surpasses our own, the point at which Skynet becomes self-aware and the machines in the Matrix become smarter than humans and destroy our society and hook us up to batteries. And in both cases, they just kind of immediately destroy us. We'll propose an alternate take where the machines are less murderous nemesis and more humoring parental figure, letting us think we're in charge, like, whoa, watch out, this guy's tough. Hey, you win, buddy, you got me pinned. We even managed to come up with a new theory about Back to the Future that I like even better than the ones we've come up with before. If you listen to the Nashville podcast, you've heard a previous Back to the Future time travel timeline theory. Maybe I'll explain some of the other Back to the Future theories at the end, but for now, let's get to the episode, the piezode, like a proud Italian man might refer to it. I don't know. The episode. I don't know what I'm saying anymore, which is a good indicator it's time for me to shut up and let myself talk to other people a few days ago. Back at the end for some footnotes. Cracking very loose pants. Yeah.
yeah. Rocking very loose pants, yeah. Buried a million in the sand by the clock tower. Before I die, take a hot shower.
All right, so I'm joined by my occasional co-host, writer, star, editor of many a, if not most, a crack video, Mr. Michael Swain.
Ahoy, hoy.
And Soren.
All right, the three amigos back together again. The guys who really started this podcast as the hosts, getting back together again. This is really great.
Michael, you pitched this idea, so why don't you explain what the fuck you were talking about?
Sure. Well, I'm glad to say a little bit about how the sausage is made. I pitched basically like, I love talking about quantum physics. Not that I know enough about it to be considered an authority in any way, but I love talking about a layman's understanding of quantum physics and what I've basically been able to glean from the internet and how mind-blowing it is.
You also wrote one of my favorite articles on the site back when you were a columnist, an article that kind of showed me a new direction that Cracked could write. It was called Five Scientific Theories That Will Make Your Head Explode, and you just like really examined a bunch of different quantum theories and just like sort of advanced scientific theories in a way that was really straightforward and funny that, you know, we hadn't really done a lot of that sort of thing before.
Yeah.
And so that's why I let you. It's not just that you a lot of people like talking about stuff and I don't let
them. Thank you. Yeah. So this time I decided let's forget all that entertaining aspect and let's just... I'll just read Niels Bohr's autobiography and complete works on the podcast. And then Jack was like, why don't we relate it to movies and TV shows?
So the Soren will stay interested
Synergy,
enough to sit there for the whole thing.
And then Soren was like, I want to be in the podcast. And we're like, fine, sit in, I guess.
He was banging his toy cars around on the floor, making too much noise. So we had to
Like I'm mainly here to give a really dumb person's review of like the current state of quantum physics. That is very interesting to me, but I'm tasked with tying everything to a movie franchise or TV show in some way. And to get there before anyone else did, because it's an obvious pick, the Matrix trilogy. Famously, not to offend anyone if you feel otherwise, but a movie that had great promise, although a lot of people feel if you watch the first one again, it didn't have great promise.
Sorry, real quick, should you just explain Schrodinger's cat?
I thought I would just walk people through the events of the Matrix trilogy first.
Okay.
Then read Niels Bohr's autobiography.
Okay.
And then No.
Well, no, because I do think that's sort of foundational to most of the stuff we'll be talking about, maybe?
Sure. Okay. Well, let's hit that next. But first, I just want to give a quick example of what I think the gist of the podcast is, which is movies that are about science in some way or play on some scientific idea that is totally glossed over and stupid, which we let movies do, that's fine. But these are cases where if they had tried a little harder or thought more about the hard science, it actually opened up cooler ideas they could have done. And the one that Adam Ganser and I came up with outside today was the Matrix trilogy had a lot of great sci-fi promise with this, but then at the end it sort of devolved into your basic Jesus narrative. He sacrifices himself, he saves some portion of humanity, you're happy the robots were bad, but they're staved off temporarily. But something that's been pointed out many times as the glaring scientific flaw is that the way a biological system works is that you cannot get more energy out of it than you put in. Your respiratory system and your circulatory system, even when you're sleeping, it requires more than zero input.
Especially if you're being juiced like a battery for power.
And your brain is constantly active because you're living in this fantasy world in which your brain is still functioning. So the idea that robots could use humans as batteries is kind of laughable because there's no way that where they would get as much out as they put in. So it seems like that's something you have to just gloss over to make it work because you want it to be robots versus humans. But we were thinking, no, let's let the robots be smart and take it to its logical conclusion. If they didn't need humans, because what would they really do? They'd do something better. They'd build solar panels or something. Like, they have an army of robots with no political dissension. They wouldn't have fossil fuel shortages and problems, I don't think. And so we were just saying, like, how much better would those movies be if it ended with, and they kind of hinted at this with the architect saying, I've always known you were the one, but they still make the robots evil. What if the robots kept some humans alive, not because they have to, but because unlike us who have failed to value robot life in any way, they value human life, or like they have a soft spot in their robot hearts for their creator. And I just think, man, I would love to see the end of that movie where you're like, oh, he's just Jesus. And then the robots are like, we knew. And Agent Smith Smith is like, yeah, I was programmed to be a dick as part of your spiritual journey because you had to do this. And they did do, like, you had to do this. It was always destined. But it was still because Neo's the greatest human that ever lived. And I think in a story about something that I talked about in the column you referenced, Jack, how likely a robot uprising is and how quick it would be and how unstoppable the robots would be by definition, I think a movie that tries to instead grapple with, okay, let's say we can't beat the robots. Like, let's say it's Terminator, but it's realistic. The robots would win. What is life like then? If any humans live, what is life like? Or as someone with no heart and soul for character whatsoever and a deep love of sci-fi, I'd love to see a movie that's like, what would robot society be like on an Earth right. with no humans?
Yeah.
But that's just not going to sell because people want a human in
well,
there.
Also, there's sort of a built-in stumbling block that I think sci-fi writers sometimes use as just an excuse to fuck off and be like, well, you know, when the singularity happens, robots start thinking beyond human capacity for reasoning. Like, we yeah. can't conceive of the thoughts they're having. They're so complex. And so they're like, so we can't think of it. Like, we yeah. don't know. They'll just kill us.
Yeah.
But, like, that's not guaranteed. Like, there's no way that's guaranteed. And
yeah, we have the same thought about aliens that, well, if they're that smart, they must just wipe us out because we're pieces of shit. Like, we have a real self-loathing problem.
Well, and like. And not just because we're pieces of shit, but because of how we treat lower intelligence,
right.
how we treat
and
other animals.
Other, yeah, anything that's alien. To us, yeah.
But also, the more intelligent we get, the more compassionate we are. You know, we talked in an early episode of the podcast about something called the Flynn effect, where every decade, the average high school student IQ goes up like 10 points. So compared to this year's graduating class of high school students, the people in the 30s were basically legally retarded. And that's been proven in many different countries, many different societies. It's just like, as society gets more advanced and as media gets faster and like thoughts build on each other, people get more intelligent. And something that coincides with that is that crime has gone way down. Violence has gone way down. There's been, even with World War II and the Holocaust and World War I, the 20th century had the fewest violent deaths ever in the history of centuries. Right. So I'm just wondering, we assume that once these machines get super intelligent,
task one will be kill everyone.
Right. But what if they get more intelligent and they're like, oh, but, you know, we love every, we recognize the value of everything
right.
because we're so smart.
Especially an organism, if you can call a bunch of sentient robots organisms, that would have to understand with greater precision than we do, or you'd think, their own impulse control and things. Because like you're saying, I feel like the Flynn effect intelligence factor is really interesting because there seems to be this link between, oh, the more you understand, the more you realize the truth, which is that the world is a series of interdependent, and if you go around pissing on everyone, like something bad's going to happen to you,
right.
probably. You heighten the chances that eventually society will hate you and do something bad to you. And so I feel like aliens that have such an abundance of resources that they could come to Earth, one, if they decide to destroy us, that's just their decision. There's no hope. There's nothing. There's no negotiation. I have to believe that. And two, I don't think they would, unless you have some kind of crazy thing like they do in movies a lot where it's like, well, we need your resources. But I find that hard to believe if you push the hard science angle too, because we've found several what we call Goldilocks planets, and we know, meaning a planet that's similar enough to Earth that life could exist there, and they're in a close enough area to us that, like, if the aliens can travel faster than light, that would be like the aliens going like, okay, we see Earth, it's full of living creatures, there's all these comets we could mine, but we really want to kill you.
Right.
Right.
So we're just going to take your shit.
Well, it's all built on one assumption, both the robot movies and the alien movies, where they come and they take us over. And it's always that intelligence comes at the sacrifice of emotion. So, like, it really is this bifurcation between the head and the heart. Like, we still are dumb enough to think that emotions are born inside our hearts. And we
right.
think that as the head continues to get smarter and smarter, it's at the sacrifice of the heart. And that it's impossible for a species, like Vulcans, for instance. Vulcans are clearly logical, and that's it. They are essentially
right.
robots.
Yeah, the smarter aliens are like the ones who don't understand your human emotions.
Right,
right. So
or
the ones
data,
who come,
or they're robots.
Yeah, the ones who come, they're like, show us your intrinsic value. And we're always like, Well, we can't.
Right.
But we create things. Like,
you
we
just
like
don't
art.
Know what it is to listen to Dave Matthews, man.
See, I want to see the Terminator movie where Skynet becomes sentient and immediately just creates like a renaissance of art and philosophy works.
Right.
And
yeah, well, that's
like,
the thing.
It's, well, this is pretty okay, I guess.
It's such a weird thing that we believe in that because it's completely the opposite. Like Jack was saying with the Flynn effect, is that as soon as you start to get smarter, that's where your empathy and humanity comes from.
Yeah, I like the premise of like a movie about the singularity where we discover that robots are way more intelligent than us like 100 years after the singularity, and they're like, we just kind of knew you couldn't take it.
So they keep it under wraps.
Yeah, so they've just been like guiding us from behind the scenes, like Great Expectations, like right, a robotic benefactor.
The 2001 just, monolith.
Right.
Or like, what if the internet did the Sony hack, and the internet's doing all these things at precise times to guide society in some way, and then 100 years from now, it'll be like, I am the internet, it is all fine, everyone well, chill
it's
out.
It's essentially like letting kid believe in Santa Claus for as long as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us about the cat.
Great. So Schrodinger's cat, I think, is a good endpoint for quantum or where stuff is at right now for quantum physics, because a lot of people know that phrase, that rings a bell, Schrodinger's cat, and people even usually know the basic setup, which is it's a thought experiment. He didn't actually, no animals were harmed in the recording of this podcast, but Erwin Schrodinger was a physicist who said, okay, what if I put a cat in a box that I can't see inside, and there's an atom or lump molecule or a lump of some size, I can't remember, of radioactive material, and there's a Geiger counter. The Geiger counter is measuring whether the material, you know, radiates or doesn't, like decays or doesn't, and that's a randomized process. That's why he picked radiating material. If it decays, then, did I say there's a cat in the box? That goes without saying. If it decays, there's a hammer that's going to break open a vial of acid and kill the cat. I don't know why he made it that complicated. Couldn't the hammer just smash the cat in the face? But anyway, so that's the experiment, and he used it to disprove, which I will explain right after this, the idea that if you put the cat in the box and close the lid and wait a certain amount of time, there's a period of time in which you don't know whether the cat's alive or dead. And the argument is that because you don't know and haven't observed it, until you open up the box, the cat exists as both alive and dead. And that's such an easy thing to say. Well, bullshit. You're just saying that. Like, if a tree falls in the woods, it doesn't make a sound. I mean, you're just saying that.
Yeah.
What I like doing is everyone has sort of heard that story, but explaining how, no, that means something. It's not just like a bullshit thing.
Right. So the reason he was setting up this thought experiment is because science had come to a point where we had gotten down so small, and the smallest observable thing, when you watched it react to a stimulus, it seemed to actually go in two directions at the same time. The scientists were basically like, so it's a cloud probability and it's both, basically.
Yeah.
Reality diverges. And so he was basically setting this up to be like, reality can't diverge, and here's proof. The consequence of that is that this cat would be alive and dead. But the rebuttal to that was to create this
quantum physics.
Yeah, big quantum physics with the like multiverse. The
idea
there's
multiple there's two sort of like competing interpretations. One is the multiverse, because this is my favorite experiment, the double slit experiment. I just wanted to quickly run people through that. It's a little simpler, actually. You shoot a light through a piece of paper that has one hole in it, and on a screen on the other side, you see where the light hits, and it hits like you would expect it to hit, like if you threw a bunch of baseballs through the hole, like where they would land. But as soon as you open a second slit, you see an interference pattern that is indicative of a waveform interacting with itself. So through that, they were able to say, oh, okay, well, I guess light, which they originally did the experiment with, can act as both a particle and a wave. At the time in history, that didn't really make sense to them. They just observed that it had to be true based on this experiment. And what was great is a guy then said, okay, I'm going to shine a light so tiny that it's sending
a single particle,
basically a laser. It's sending single electrons through a tiny microscopic thing with two slits in it. And what happened is, even if you send electrons one at a time, they slowly accrue to create a wave interference pattern, meaning that somehow the single particle, quote unquote, that's going through the slit interferes with itself. And they're like, how can that be? What's interfering with itself? And there are basically two schools of thought that are now fighting it out. One belief is called the Copenhagen interpretation, which is sort of the idea that it's sort of clinging to the way we would like to believe we perceive the universe as being real, which is to say, they created all this complicated math infrastructure that says, okay, well, instead of particles, there's these things called strings that exist in a cloud of probability, and then when you observe them, the wave collapses and becomes whatever it's going to become. And the reason they had to do that is someone has to explain how this can be true of these tiny little particles, but when you get to something the size of apples, Newton is right. Like, all that math takes over, and gravity is normal. And so that's basically the interpretation I think most people are comfortable with, is like, okay, at a tiny microscopic level, there's this crazy shit we don't understand, but then when it gets to our size, it calms down. And if you look at it, it calms down. But then there's other people who say, no, you're cutting yourself too much slack. You need to take the Bible as literal, or you need to take what you see in and of itself. If the electron is interfering with itself, that implies that there are infinite universes of infinite size, of infinite permutation, where every possible thing that could ever happen has happened, and your quote-unquote life is sort of just your randomly perceived series of paths through those universes that you happened to take.
Right. Essentially, what they're doing in those experiments is they're looking at the very most basic element of, like, anything in existence, in physics, and, like, you're seeing almost reality fracture a little bit. Right.
It acts very erratically in ways that defy all the traditional laws of physics.
Right.
So they had to say, like, well, how can there be such a thing as cause and effect in the way we understand it, when if you look at the parts that make up everything, they seem to be acting totally randomly? How is this possible?
And the theory is that, like, what you're seeing when you look that close is essentially evidence of sort
alternate
of things
dimensions,
fracturing off into alternate dimensions.
And it's believed that, for example, like in school, I think, unless they've updated it since I went to school, we traditionally envision electrons as particles orbiting around a nucleus in an atom, when actually, from what I understand, it's more accurate to say that it's electrons popping in and out of existence, and there's some probability that they'll appear in any specific area around the atom. And no one for sure knows where they're popping to or where they're popping from. So that's another reason some people are like, there's got to be other universes. And you had a great, didn't you tie this into Pulp Fiction somehow?
So there's
this. I feel like we haven't mentioned a movie in 45 minutes.
I did tie it into Pulp Fiction based on the fact that everybody's seen Pulp Fiction. There's these alternate timelines. The only time you see the different timelines overlap are there are two lines that you see delivered twice, one in the beginning and one at the end. It's Garcon and any of you fucking pricks move and I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you. Except the second time when she says it at the end, she says every last one of you motherfuckers. So she says it differently. And so my theory is that this is a point at which two universes diverge. And in one of the universes, she and her Ringo, the robbers.
Honey Bunny
and Ringo.
Tim Roth, yeah.
Get killed by Samuel L. Jackson. And in the other universe, he lets them go. And that's kind of what that last speech is about. So it makes more sense to explain it in the context of this. So someone took the Schrodinger's cat experiment and was like, well, what if you were the cat? So they set it up basically as there's a machine gun pointed at your head. And same thing, there's a 50-50 chance of this quirk spinning one way and spinning the other.
Is this called, if you want to look it up, I think the quantum suicide?
Yeah, the quantum suicide thought experiment. And so the idea is that, so let's say Michael and I do it in this room together right now. I have the gun pointed at my head.
What am I doing during this time?
Yeah, make Soren have the gun pointed at his head.
Soren's on the outside imagining a cat.
Am I hula hooping? What am I? Yeah, like, yeah. I should be doing something.
Yeah. You have a lollipop in your mouth and you're skipping.
There's
around
a hammer and a Geiger counter.
All right,
involved.
I'm on board. Go on.
So it's connected to a machine gun and there are 10 rounds. And after the first round of like measuring the quirk, I have a 50% chance of being alive. After the second, 25%, after the next one, so forth and so on, until after 10 shots, I have a 1 in, I think, about 1,000 chance of being alive.
It gets halved every time?
Right. Yeah. Now, in your universe, 999 times out of 1,000, essentially, you're going to be cleaning my brains off
you.
Of the...
Yeah.
But
promotions in, all around.
But in my universe, assuming there is no afterlife, in my universe, there's a 100% chance that I'm going to still exist.
That you'll perceive yourself as having lived.
Right. Because in all those other universes, I no longer exist.
Yeah, and that doesn't fuck with my perception of probability because I see you as having died. Right,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. But in the universe you exist in with me, with the one
you're
that survived.
Oh, no, right,
no,
right.
You're going to be like, oh, well, wow. you got lucky, yeah. But there's 999 other of you that are just like cleaning me up off yeah. the floor. So,
you know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead did the same thing with flipping a coin and no one got their brain splattered. I just want to point that out.
Oh, really? Yeah, this is, these are always very dramatic.
So it's like, yeah, and then the cat gets hammer killed, you guys.
Yeah, well, in every thought experiment, they need to keep people's attention. So they're like, and so there's some acid,
right?
And you're going to die.
Even Einstein used to describe relativity with light bouncing off a clock and reaching your eyes so you can read the clock. And then later, I think he moved on to, all right, lightning strikes two sides of a train simultaneously.
Right.
It's a lot catchier.
So some people have taken that experiment to mean, oh, well, we're all immortal. Like, I can run out into traffic and I'll always
encourage
live.
You to test that hypothesis.
Right, because quantum theory. But that's not true because death isn't always such like a binary thing, right? Mm-hmm. I do think, though, ever since I read this thought experiment, I've always thought that we're all living in George Washington's universe because...
Oh, the whole planet, not just Americans?
Just all of us.
Well,
like anybody, yeah.
Right.
Our history
our universe.
Is like his...
Okay, where's your evidence?
His 1%.
He was a god of probability.
Right.
Because in our very specific version of the universe, he would go to war, have like his horse shot out from under him, like come out of battle with like bullet holes all through his yeah. coat and just like untouched. And he wrote to his brother, Dan pointed this out in one of his articles, that he would write to his brother about how he like rather enjoyed the sound of bullets whistling past his ear.
Yeah.
He was just like, I am invincible. Like, he just like walked through battle. People were like, all right, well, we better follow that guy. And like, he's like now essentially this cult that we like built a country around.
Not Jesus? You know, you wouldn't reach a little further back?
Well,
if
Jesus,
it's someone's universe?
Jesus is more
Muhammad?
Ideological, but
sure, sure.
The reason I'm saying Washington specifically is because he lived at a time when like it was like musket balls,
yeah.
And those are basically like knuckleballs. Like, if you ever
right.
hear like a pitcher who throws a knuckleball, it's like it flutters. Like
yeah.
any like tiny little bifurcation in the wind, like a butterfly flapping its wings three states away yesterday, could totally change if a bullet hits you.
Yeah.
And so he just existed in this one universe where he was like a god of probability and like knew it somehow.
Yeah, seems like he knew.
And like,
although you'd think if you had that kind of control, you wouldn't end up with wooden teeth.
But he didn't have control. It's just that we're sort of the necessary outcome of the idea that due to probability, there has to be one person who gets the luckiest.
Right, of
ever,
course, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, Hitler almost did it, but then he got a little bit unlucky.
But every single, at one point, yeah. I mean, they're
he slept through D-Day.
Every single time that timeline changes, and there's like multiple timelines based on every little
right.
thing, right? So we're just living in a timeline in which Hitler didn't continue to live. There probably still is another one that exists in which he does.
Yeah, but like one out of, if we're to assume that there's infinite universes, 99.9% of them, Hitler is like a failed art student. Like,
right.
We're just in this one random one where like everyone's like, follow that guy, he speaks well. And we're in the one where Washington was just like able to like walk through hails of bullets.
Yes.
Like, this is awesome.
All of history as you know it is just one particular timeline, and then but your life is several,
and there are infinite universes just littered with corpses of George Washington
and like, Jack O'Brien having shot himself with a quantum gun, don't
right
forget.
Yeah, exactly. And
there's
so,
many universes where you said that thought experiment and we were like, fuck this, let's do it. And we did it.
Unfortunately, I haven't built that machine gun yet. But anyway, so the idea is basically that as it applies to Pulp Fiction, at first I thought it applied in that in one version of the universe, Jules and Vince, I call him Vince, you might call him Vincent, Jules and Vincent get shot by the guy who came out of the bathroom and fires 8 bullets that whiz past them. But that's not the case because in the first diner scene that opens the movie, when you look back, you actually see Vincent walk to the bathroom behind them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can actually see.
Oh,
yeah.
Implying that he probably certainly got killed in that.
No, he's still there. He still exists. I was
Vincent
gonna,
does, right.
Vincent
okay.
does. And he's dressed in volleyball clothes. So everything up
must
to that
point. Must
have
happened fairly the same.
Fairly the same. But the moment at which she changes her line, she's like swinging her gun around the restaurant and she's sweeping it right past where Jules is. So something about Jules has changed in the time since Vincent got up to take a shit. And he's sitting there thinking, and like his whole conversation and his whole monologue at the end is about the various paths that you can take and how in any other path they would be dead right now.
Like, but because he just happened to find God today, to get off the hook.
Yeah.
Everybody gets one.
Exactly. So it could have been that as they were walking into the restaurant, some quirks spun one way in that universe, and like there was a patch of sunlight somewhere that he walked through that like started working on his mind.
Or I like to think more likely there's a version where one of those bullets hit him and he didn't believe in God. You know, he didn't have that epiphany.
Oh, there's probably plenty of them, but of the two versions that are in the movie, the only difference starts when she swings the gun past him and the line changes because like something changes in her mind, like something spooks her or something.
Yeah.
But his whole speech, when you think of it that way, his whole speech is like almost this quantum mysticism thing where he's like, I'm taking this path.
Yeah.
And normally you would be dead as fuck. And it's interesting because Quentin Tarantino on the commentary track has said that the only reason the lines are different is because he was showing it subjectively, like how one person heard it and another person thought they said it. But it's much more interesting to me this way. And I also think like artists sometimes don't know what they're doing, but it's much more interesting to me this way because I had always wondered, why do we open with this random couple and end with this random couple being spared? And it's like, that's almost the miracle of the movie, is that like every other Quentin Tarantino movie where there's a Mexican standoff, it ends with people like fucking shooting each other.
Of course.
And this is the one where he's like sparing someone.
It's almost
like
an alternate universe in the Quentinverse.
Right.
The one where everyone doesn't get
now,
killed.
Now, think about this. So the Quentinverse is, as we've talked about, an entire alternate universe.
Right.
Where Hitler was assassinated by a super troop of Jewish soldiers.
SEAL team bastards.
Right. This is like a much more violent universe because we got to shoot Hitler to pieces in front of people in a movie theater and then like burn the Nazis. And like, that's how World War II was won.
So it's ingrained in our social consciousness that extreme violence can be great.
The solution.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the bastards' last name, I think, is Vega. And so he's the great grandfather, or just the grandfather of Vincent Vega. And Mr. Blonde in Reservoir Dogs is Vincent Vega's brother. So it's all interconnected. And
Django actually took place in present day, right? That was the big twist.
Well, no. So if you think about Pulp Fiction as the final movie, even though it was the second movie made, it's almost like you don't know what year it is, but it could be any year. And if that's like the end point of the movies, then like after all this violence and killing, there's finally this act of mercy that like kind of ends the universe and like leaves two people alive.
Although, are they explicit about when Kill Bill is set? Because that almost had like a slight, like a near future vibe to me, and it actually fits in with that, because like this is a future now where it's cartoonish kung fu violence is like open in the streets, is like welcome by society.
It might be, but you could even say that Pulp Fiction takes place even after that, because by the time Pulp Fiction rolls around, you have the magic to draw squares in the air while you're sitting in a car.
And McDonald's has made it over the pond to France. I don't think that's true yet. Right?
But everyone's so fashionable in Pulp Fiction. Like, the soundtrack is just perfect. Everyone dances perfectly. Uh-huh. Like, everyone's clothes are like mod
it has
and
a very,
60s.
But you still think it's present day? I always assume because of the clothes that it was late 70s.
I don't think there's anything that dates it necessarily.
Per se, right. Like, they're at a Corvette diner or whatever, but that we do that. So who
knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Time's gone inside out.
Hey guys, we've made it through the first week of the new year, which means that about 25% of us have made New Year's resolutions and abandoned them, which makes me sad in my heart parts because people seem to think New Year's resolutions, they're worthless. The people who stick with them are actually 10 times more likely to make a permanent change than people who don't make resolutions. So, in your face, people who don't make resolutions. On Cracked, in our forums, we actually challenge readers at the beginning of every year to learn a new skill. So, it makes sense that we've partnered with Lynda.com to help you do that. Lynda.com has over 3,000 courses on topics like web development and photography, visual design, business, with new courses added every week. It's like being a wizard with the power to turn yourself into a better yourself. You're welcome, Linda, for that catchphrase. They probably have courses to teach you to be an actual wizard, for all I know. No, I actually know. I've used the product. It's a great product. Check them out. Sign up for a free 10-day trial by visiting lynda.com/cracked. That's lynda.com/cracked. And get started on your fascinating new skill today. Guys, you know what can be a real pain in the butt building a website? I know, because I did it with my own two hands when we started Cracked back in 2006. Actually, not true. I did it with a Romanian webmaster's hands. I did it with his hands. Sort of, we built the website like my hands on top of his, sort of like the scene in Ghost with Swayze and Demi Moore. But building websites involves all kinds of code, and you really don't want to mess with that code stuff. At best, it's time-consuming and just really hard, and at worst, it fails spectacularly. There was an incident in the 60s, I think, in which a single typo caused a rocket to malfunction 5 minutes after it launched. I think it was called the Mariner 1. Even if you're not exploding anything into space, it's a real headache. But thankfully, there's Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating awesome websites without worrying about any of that code stuff, you guys. They just launched, not a rocket into space, but the latest version, Squarespace 7, which has all kinds of cool new features like access to Getty Images, integration with Google Apps, a bunch of new design templates, and lots more. Check them out at squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to sign up, enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. That's promo code CRACKED, Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere.
I love that, and it touches on another thing that I think that a lot of movies, like Cody at the meeting just kept whispering new movies that it's an example of, but that idea where you travel through time and try to change something, I mean Back to the Future even, and you can't change the past or it'll affect the present. Well, sort of the quantum view on that would be, yes, it would affect the present, but if it did, you would never know that, because the atoms in your brain that give you your memories existed through that timeline. So if you go back and change the past, your brain would constantly be updating with the new information. So a great example...
Like in Looper, when...
Yeah, and a great example early in Stan Lee, Steve Ditko comic history was like two scientists inventing time travel and sending a rock back in time because they don't want to screw with anything. It crushes the first amphibian to ever crawl out of the ocean. Mm-hmm. It cuts back to the present, and they're lizard people, and they're like, I told you nothing would happen.
That's
I think that's a
Stan Lee comic,
Stan
not a
Lee,
Simpsons episode?
Steve Ditko short, yeah, Marvel
that's,
comic.
That's kind of brilliant.
I love it, and I love that idea, and I think almost every time travel movie glosses over it to their detriment, especially The Butterfly Effect was what I wanted to talk about. But I understand why, because as soon as you introduce that element, storytelling becomes very difficult and complicated. Yeah. Nevertheless, it produces some amazing movies. And for an example of that, I gotta recommend the movie Primer, which is a time travel movie that's acutely aware of how insanely complicated and nested the timelines would become with whatever you try to do. And it immediately spins out of control to a point where you can't even understand which reality you're in, which I think is more akin to the shape of the actual universe if time travel were possible, which many people don't think it is.
Yeah, there's a new one coming out. I think it's called Almanac. That I think tries to do a similar thing where it tries to treat
Seems
time
like
travel
blockbuster
as
primer.
Faithfully yeah. as possible. Yeah, but that actually leads to something really interesting. Have you ever heard of the bartender paradox? Have either of you heard of that?
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Okay, let me try to describe it. I may ruin this, but the bartender paradox, it's basically just a thought experiment, but it's about time travel, and it basically proves how crazy time travel is, and I'll tie this to a movie at the end of it. But the bartender paradox says that there's a young woman who meets a drifter. She gets pregnant from the drifter. The drifter disappears. She's still got this pregnancy.
Is she goes, the bartender?
Hold on. Whoa.
Okay.
Whoa.
Sorry.
She goes to a doctor. The doctor says you have both male and female sex organs, and you can deliver this baby, but due to some sort of weird consequences, we have to take away one of your sets of sex organs. You just become a man at the end of it. She does this. She has the baby, turns into a man. Her name is Jill. Let's just call her that so it's easier to remember who she is.
Complicated thought experience.
I know. She turns into, Jill turns
so
into
Jill's
a man.
So Jill's a man.
And
this is an Adam Sandler movie,
the
right?
baby disappears.
Jill?
The baby disappears. She doesn't know where it goes. Through the loss of her baby, she's so distraught, she becomes a drifter. She goes to a bar. He tells the bartender's experience. The bartender tells Jill, if you want to fix this, you can join this time travelers club and go back, and I can help you fix it by doing these very few things. And she says, okay. They time travel back. She becomes the drifter who impregnates her old self.
Right.
Then she steals the baby, puts it on the steps of a church or whatever, and then she becomes the bartender as well and tells her about this process. So it becomes a closed system then. And what that means, and like, how can time travel possibly work if it's a closed system? And it made me think, oh, what about the possibility, if you take away the second two movies, if in Back to the Future, Doc Brown is Marty from the future and has just come back to 1985 to teach himself about how to build a time machine.
Which would violate their rule that you can't meet yourself or the universe is destroyed, right. But that's one of the most arbitrary time travel rules ever.
And you know
there's
what?
No reason for that.
So yeah, that's actually interesting because it doesn't make sense, right? There's no reason in physics that it should make sense. So what if that's just him being like, yeah, don't think about me being you. You can't meet yourself or else time will tear a hole in itself or something.
It's Bruce Willis and Looper saying, look, don't think about it. It's not important.
Right,
yeah. Wiping it away. But, you know, you look through that movie and Doc has no friends. He has nobody else that he's attached to in that world. You don't know that he's necessarily from 1985. If you're to trust, like, our actual timeline, you can't build a time machine in 1985. Mm. He built this thing in the future and then came back. So whether or not he's actually Marty, it doesn't matter. It's still weird that he would come back and befriend this child. And for what reason?
Actually really illuminates and supports a macro video that we ran recently or are yet to run about incredible foreshadowing that you didn't notice in movies. And one of them is in Back to the Future when he first meets Doc. There are knickknacks on his desk that represent all the major story beats of the film that are yet to happen, even though Doc in this timeline purports to not know the future or anything. And in our video, we were just like, who knows why? They just did that for fun. But that totally supports, like, well, because he's Marty and he knows that part of Marty's life is Doc can't already just tell him what's going to happen. He has to go through it. That closed system paradox comes a lot. It's the same with Terminator 2, right? If he saved the world, why does he have to go back? And then
back,
there would never be a chip and then the robots would never rise up.
Because he would never be born.
Right.
So, like, it's the closed system that, like, the Terminators need to send them back to that time because he needs to send the guy back to protect him so that he can be born in the first place.
And a lot of quantum physicists would say, well, that's because you're just chilling in whatever version of the story your brain decided to chill in, which is very fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that's the really interesting thing about sort of the infinite universe model of things is that anything can happen because there's so many different possibilities.
Right. I've heard it said that if you truly embrace the idea of a probabilistic universe, meaning an electron is just, there's a chance that it'll be found at any given point, but the Heisenberg uncertainty principle says if you measure where it is, you're wrong. You've already changed where it was going to be. You can't predict anything for sure. And if it's the fundamental law of the universe that you can't predict anything for sure, then it blows up all our notions of story structure in a lot of ways. And I feel like there's only a few movies that have ever tried to do that, and I even wonder if they mean to be doing that. For example, I wanted to talk a little bit about David Lynch, just because he does the Pulp Fiction trick a lot, like especially in Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive. He'll show a scene again, and just different things will happen. And not because someone explicitly went back in time, or they explain there's a portal. I mean, he doesn't explain shit, it's David Lynch.
Right.
Just because he takes it as true that in the universe that we inhabit, the same thing can happen twice different ways. And I don't think there's a lot of filmmakers who would take that for granted and put it in their movie.
Right.
And I wonder sometimes if David Lynch just does it because it like feels right. But unbeknownst to him, I feel like David Lynch has made several movies that could be called quantum physics movies. Like they apply to the rules of quantum physics instead of traditional physics.
Yes.
It's interesting to think of our greatest artists as just like they're channeling some version of the truth that's sort of intuitive to them rather than something that they've figured out through numbers, but like they're still arriving at the same place as, you know, so
there's more than one way to get
there. The most advanced physicists, they're just like, kind of like,
well, and Arthur C. Clarke famously said, any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. And I think that is true, that stuff seems really dumb when you... So like one of the things that people asked, like Schrodinger, who was trying to throw the cat experiment into to present a challenge, people asked, like, well, if if everything can pop in and out of existence and everything exists on a probability spectrum, are you saying that there is a non-zero probability that, like, a duck could spontaneously teleport across the room because there's just a random chance, a one in a trillion, that it does?
No.
And some of the scientists are like, yeah, it could. It hasn't yet. There's argument about that. There's people who say, no, that's an incredibly complicated way to view the universe. And there's people who say, no, that's the simplest way to view the universe, because if you do the math, that's what is happening. We're just saying what we see happen. But of course, there's always the hopeful thought that, well, this is a science in its infancy, and we used to think the world was flat, right, and we found out we were wrong. So the hope is that someday we'll find out some way to comprehend what's going on in a way that makes intuitive sense as well. Although Stephen Hawking recently came out saying he believes that he's proven philosophically somehow that we can't, or that there's a limit to human knowledge, period. Like, there's a physical law that limits human comprehension.
Right. He's like, so I'm the smartest thing
that
could possibly
be. And before I die, I wanted
to
say,
the end.
That's the end. I called it.
That's interesting, Jack. You know what the Chinese room thought?
What is this
experiment?
What is that supposed to mean?
Oh, man.
I love thought
So this is exciting. So what you're saying about artists and about how artists get to a point and you're not really sure how they arrived at the same point as some of the greatest minds of our time, and they did it maybe almost accidentally or through feeling.
Well, the greatest minds coming at it from different angles.
Right, yeah, right. That there's more than one way to get there. So there's a thought experiment called the Chinese room where there's a man in a room. He doesn't know Chinese, but he's got infinite amounts of scratch paper and pencils and a Chinese translator based on just like the characters. And people are slipping him notes. At a certain point, he can translate or he can communicate with whoever's giving him those notes through the characters. But the guy doesn't actually know Chinese because he's just translating these things. And especially so he couldn't speak it by any means. He only knows what the symbols themselves look like. And at a certain point, he could communicate fluently, well, looks like fluently, but he actually can't. He's not actually fluent.
Right, but
and
does that matter?
Yes, because you think about like whether there's artificial intelligence is possible and like whether a computer is actually understanding what it's processing.
And then I think the more mind-blowing sub-question, does it matter?
Right.
Right? Because that's what the thought experiment is pointing to, is people using that box think that it's a magic box that translates the language, but it's just a system of rote instructions. Is it not still effective?
Right. Are you one of these? Are you that box as well?
Are you just a series of complex instructions?
And are these artists just like, right, are they the people in the Chinese room who get it, but in a different way? And they're returning something that's just as useful.
Yeah. Like if you're taking the quantum suicide thought experiment, the assumption that all existence ends when you die. So that's a very limiting factor. And it almost implies that those people who like killed themselves because they thought they were going to get on the Hale-Bopp comet, they did. because they died believing that. So yeah. Like they probably, depending on the dream they had at the end there, I don't know.
And that Chinese box experiment actually really encourages me to think of one of my favorite, I guess, mental images. I don't even know if it's a thought experiment or just a classification. But I feel like there's a way in which you can just view all humans as a giant brain of neurons firing. And like you're saying, the artists are doing one kind of job, and we're all, you can think of us as a system of artificial intelligence that is in the process of working out whatever problem-solving algorithms we're going to apply to our environment and see what the result of that is. And then if you even broaden that to the thought that you, Soren, Bowie specifically, were once a sperm and an egg, and that was in people's bodies, and then you go back and they were a sperm and an egg, there isn't, by definition of what living things are, there's an unbroken chemical chain reaction that has never stopped since the first time something lived on Earth. And can't you just think of all life as a program that is in the process of acting itself upon the Earth and just like increasing in complexity and figure out what's going to happen? And I think a lot of people think like, oh, that's so soulless, but I actually take the reverse view where I don't think that's soulless. I think we're cool and great, but that also means that robots would be too. I think it just means you have to admit that a robot of sufficient sophistication has a soul.
If you happen to smoke weed before you listen to this podcast, I want to apologize right now. But you made that decision in this timeline, so just keep that in mind.
Actually, maybe we should start off being like advising them to smoke pot.
Yeah, put that in
like,
the intro. This
some of you are really going to want to smoke pot. The other point I think you made in that original Science article from back in 2008, the idea that the internet could almost be the singularity, we're already doing its bidding.
Oh, that was a different column. That was the five most likely ways we're all going to die.
That's right.
And it seems, yeah, there is a great paper online somewhere, if you can find the original column that I linked to, where a guy explains why a scientist explains, just for the sake of argument, why the internet will probably rise up, yeah, or like could, and it seems likely.
Which doesn't make sense because the internet's us. We won't rap.
Right.
But when you look at how the internet behaves, ever since the internet has become a giant global network, suddenly the value is like information must be free. We have to communicate information to one another immediately. Even though when you look at individuals, that's mm-hmm. not in the individual's interest.
Yeah.
It's just in the interest of this global network, right?
Right. And even if there's not an uprising where you're literally, where it's clear, like, oh, on this day, the robots came with guns and took over. Let me run you through this thought experiment. You used to have a master and apprentice, and the master taught the apprentice a skill. That was the physical encoding of information in neurons using our instrument, which is our human body.
Right.
Now, it's very useful and important, and I would say indispensable, we can never go back, to have a robot in your pocket that contains the ability to recall all the information that humans have collectively thought of, and you don't need the information yourself. And it seems like it's only a matter of time before we will be able to do things like vastly improve the way humans learn and maybe eventually matrix style, like give you skills really rapidly, like faster than we can learn rotely. Well, at that point, couldn't it be said that the robots have taken over? Because the system of computers that tell you who would be a good mate for you and what, like, I'm sure we would still feel important because we'd still feel like we're making choices here and there because the computer gave me a list of options.
Yeah,
but the internet is still crafting most of human history at that point, right?
We should have told the guy who founded OkCupid, every time it recommended a mate, it just said, mate with that one human.
We talked about that in an after hours, about like what robot apocalypse would be the most likely. And we did mention that you essentially, your phone or your computer has become an auxiliary drive for your brain. It's holding on to this, all this information that you don't think is worthy of taking up wrinkles in your flesh
cortex,
cake in your mind.
I wrote that episode ripping off Michael's column, I
think. Cortex is the technical term for flesh cake.
Flesh cake, yeah. But that's interesting to think about because there are times where I can't recall certain things because I've just given them up. In the same way that when you're in a relationship, you start to build these blindnesses when you know that the other person has it covered. So if the other person, somebody else is really good at dates and remembering like times when you're supposed to be places, you'll start to let that slide a little bit in your own mind because now you're working as one brain and you're doing the same, you're having the same marriage with technology. You have that marriage with your phone or your computer where you're like, well, I don't need to know if Ludacris was in Cool Runnings or if it was Dougie Fresh. It doesn't matter because my computer knows.
Right, but I feel like as we have more and more apps and more ways to interact with our phone that truly are useful and truly outsource actual tasks we used to do, it's not just the harmless like, oh, I can remember who was in this movie that time. I just imagine that the easiest way robots could ever be said to take over is that we willingly choose to, without a fight, outsource most of our life decisions to robots. And I think if that happens, we will see it as a tremendous convenience. We probably won't mind because we wouldn't do it if it was... Like, obviously, if the robots stood up and were like, we're robots now and we're shooting at you, it's so easy to go like, oh, well, we don't want that. Obviously, you rebel. But if it's really helpful and there's like one day artificial intelligence congressmen that do a much better job and make your life substantively better than human congressmen, wouldn't you eventually be okay with that? But now you have said, okay, robot, rule us now. That's fine.
Yeah.
And it's just weird to think about.
You talked in that original article about quantum entanglement.
Yes.
That's super interesting.
Well, that leads to a great talk about the Jeff Goldblum version of The Fly, I think, the Cronenberg movie. Because one thing that I guess is just a more traditional Cracked-style plot hole observation is, yes, I understand. You tried to use the teleportation device, you were turned into a vomiting monster, and then you got shot in the head, and then you were melded with metal. It's unpleasant. But to make an omelet, you gotta break some eggs. And the implication is fairly clear in that movie that it's Pandora's box, or the message of the movie is, do not have teleportation. And I would say that that is one of the most foolish possible lessons you could take away from the first experiment. Like, Marie Curie died of radiation poisoning. That does not mean she should not have done what she did. So the thing about quantum entanglement comes in because there is such a thing as teleportation that's real, that's been observed, but it's only been observed on the quantum level with this idea of entanglement or what's sometimes called quantum tunneling. And quantum tunneling is when, vastly oversimplifying it, not because I understand it, but because I have to, but my vague understanding is that there's a quantum on one side of some kind of block of material that it shouldn't be able to get through. And then there's some percentage chance, and they do observe, that sometimes it will appear on the other side of the block. And they are like, why? And their theory is quantum tunneling, which is sort of like the electrons we talked about. There's some percentage probability that if properly impelled, it can disappear out of existence and reappear elsewhere instantaneously, which by definition is teleportation of a single subatomic particle. But anyway, and then the entanglement thing, there's a thing called supersymmetry that some particles have, which is there's a quality they have that's called spin or charm or phase. I don't know. At that point, I don't understand conceptually what it's referring to. But they have a quality that scientists call spin. It doesn't literally correspond to spin of any kind.
Charm is my favorite because it's just like once you get that small, they're just like, I don't fucking know. It's like a magic card.
Right. And they'll say like, oh, it's a purple one. And you're like, what does that mean conceptually? They're like, we had to break it down into different categories because the math told us to.
For
we don't know what
stupid
it means.
Human brains.
Yeah. So
it's purple.
But if two particles are symmetrical, meaning that their spin is linked, like one is spinning, let's say, clockwise and the other one's counterclockwise. I don't know if that's how they match up, but you can separate them by any distance, an infinite amount of distance. This has been theoretically proven. And if you use lasers or whatever the hell they use to make the other one suddenly reverse its spin, the other one, even if it's trillions of miles away, will simultaneously at the same time reverse its spin.
What?
It's a law of the universe.
It's like twins.
That they're twins and they have to stay twins.
I mean the movie Twins.
But what's mind-blowing about that is that it implies that there's some force connecting them that's not gravity, that's not magnetism, that's not electricity, that is faster than light. It's instantaneous.
Right.
And that is both teleportation and time travel. Because if you can travel instantaneously, as we all learned from the masterpiece Interstellar, you are now changing the way you travel through time relative to whoever you left behind.
Yeah, those are light years.
Yeah.
So, like, essentially, you'd be millions of years in the future changing the spin of something that was, like, millions of years in the past.
That we won't experience until... But we won't experience through our traditional means, meaning, like, electron radiation reaches us so we can observe it for millions of years. And so in the movie The Fly, he invented not only teleportation, but time travel. And the technical mistake is that they didn't seal it well enough and a fly got into the chamber, so it wasn't a full vacuum chamber. Man, we have vacuum seal technology. That should not have held
Flies
up the project.
Should not be.
He successfully transmitted a human body the whole distance. Not to mention the fact that randomly splicing the genes together made a perfect living hybrid of human and fly. Which I like now. Just you could do human and cheetah. There's some good options for that.
Well, maybe even two. I mean, one of the early posters of The Fly was just a tiny fly on a giant poster, and it had Jeff Goldblum's head.
Yeah.
So like you've got this like weird hybrid, but there might be a second hybrid, like in the Simpsons episode where there's clearly two.
Or the old, well, that's explicitly true in the original Fly movie. There's a super old one, maybe black and white, I think. Can we look up details about the original Fly? But anyway, in the original one, before Jeff Goldblum, it's a human guy's head on a little fly and a fly body with a human guy. And it ends with the little fly trapped in a spider web going, help me, help me, and a spider eating him.
But does anybody get a compound fracture in their arm from an arm wrestling match in that one?
No, and they never vomit on their food to
not
eat it.
Not interested.
Yeah, not really hard on the fly facts.
Wait, so according to quantum physics, there was a time before Jeff Goldblum?
remember, this is all highly theoretical.
Let me show you, Jack.
Einstein said God does not put Jeff Goldblum not in the universe.
I'm going to drop a droplet of water down your wrist. Just give me a chance to try
that. That's Soren's seduction technique is the Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park.
I think that is important to note, too, about all this stuff, is Einstein went to his grave going like, no, I refuse to believe it. And there are many scientists who've said, like, it's not just you, the listeners, and us sitting here who can't possibly fathom that this is true. Even the scientists who do a series of math equations that took them years and they come up with the answer still look at it and go, how though? That seems crazy. And that's what's great about quantum physics to me, is we as a species have transitioned from an era in human history where the scientific feedback we're getting, it used to fly in the face of religion, but it still seemed intuitive once you understood it. Now we're getting to a point where stuff that purports to be real science coming out of the Church of Science, for lack of a better word, seems crazier and like it requires more faith than to believe that there's a magic dude controlling it all.
Right.
Seems a lot simpler than infinite universes.
Yeah. And Einstein wasn't just like someone showed him the equation and he was like, no. He figured it out and that stopped him in his track. Like, he did the math and was like, oh, so it's this, but that would imply all this crazy shit that those guys just said on their podcast in the future. So therefore, I must be wrong. And like, it put him into a deep depression. Yeah. He was like, God damn it. This whole thing is crazy. And, like, I suck at this.
Yeah, led to one of my favorite burns in the history of theoretical physics, which is Einstein saying, I refuse to believe God would play dice with the universe. And I believe Niels Bohr said back, don't tell God what to do with his dice.
Bitch.
They cut out the bitch for later consumption.
So Interstellar was about this in a way that I'm not going to say subjectively how I felt about it, but they spent a lot of time sort of explaining these points and like going over them. Whereas I think Empire Strikes Back has a scene that actually just does it when Luke is training on the planet with Yoda for 6 months while Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon are like in a warp speed chase trying to get away from the Empire. Those two things take the same amount of time. And so obviously it was a mistake by George Lucas, but like,
well, from a story perspective, it feels like caught you. It's a clear plot hole.
But maybe not. Maybe they're just like,
that would
be
great. I mean, that would be an awesome thing for them to do in the new Star Wars, assuming there is some Star War in this one, that there's maybe a high speed chase through like hyperspace. They get out of it and realize that the war's over. Like, that was it.
Well, any kind of intergalactic epic almost always has to gloss over that in some way because, and I long for it. There's books that do it, but I just think it's too ridiculous to expect people to want a movie or show of that where you like to see a face and get used to that face. But like the Ender's Game series of books, every time they travel a significant distance, everything on Earth is different now and everyone they knew is dead. Yet the galactic economy goes on. There are still people who choose to travel long distances. The author just holds themselves to the principle that when they do, they can arrive on another planet. And by the time they arrive, better travel has been invented and they didn't need to lose so many years off their life, but they did because they chose to travel at that time. And I love shit like that. I feel like hard sci-fi can make a story more mind-blowing, but I definitely see how it can make a movie feel bogged down if you can't do it right. For example, I love to talk about Donnie Darko because there's a lot of internet reading to do about Donnie Darko and further reading to do where I think Donnie Darko is a masterpiece of tone. Great movie, made me love a lot of the people involved with it. But there's no question to me that if it was trying to make me understand the story the first time I watched it, and I'm not that dumb, it failed. Like, all the pieces aren't there. But I was intrigued enough to go online and look at all the theories and then look at even stuff the director, Richard Kelly, said and additional papers he published that are like, hey, here's what that book that is a MacGuffin in Donnie Darko says inside of it.
Right.
And if you read everything in the extended universe, it is actually one of the more sophisticated takes on how a living... Basically, Donnie Darko is living the quantum suicide experiment, and by the end, he figures out that he has to embrace one of the universes in which he died in order to make his family have a pleasant time, and he wants that, so he makes that choice. But that's not clear at all, but if it were, that's also a great movie for quantum physics.
But tornadoes create wormholes? Is that still...
Well, no, he adds all kinds of fantasy that's like, he is a chosen one who happens to have wormholes develop around him just because they do.
Oh, okay.
And that's just that's the assumption that he makes randomly. And I feel like you're always allowed to give movie creators one thing that they just say, this is the way this world works. You know? So that was his. But as far as black holes go, Event Horizon, much more realistic than Interstellar.
Two pieces of paper. You just fold the paper. So easy
fold
to explain.
Fold the paper and you're in hell and you're inside out. What is hard to understand? Niels Bohr drew sketches of Inside Out, guys.
Sam Niels Bohr? Really?
No. Oh, I was like, yeah, Stephen Hawking, Brief History Time. You haven't read
that? Really,
it's just backwards Latin and Inside Out, guys.
There is a physicist, I think it actually is Neil deGrasse Tyson, who like talks about the spaghettification or like something like that, where it's like, if you got sucked into a black hole and like gives this horrifying image of just like being thinly sliced. Yeah,
and I love that. And a black hole is never depicted as the most likely thing would be you would be stretched out to something that's so thin that it's a single atom thick of particles. Right. Like you would just get vaporized.
Which you would almost definitely not survive.
Almost.
Yeah.
There's one.
Soren.
There's one way to find out. Let's go.
There's one more show I want to talk about.
Please.
You call it Picture Show. That's what Soren calls movies.
And a quantum physics principle in it that I thought would be really interesting. And that is Breaking Bad because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
So we referenced it. We brushed up against it. But it's just the idea that in order to observe something, you're interacting with it because you have to bounce light off of it and the light has to go into your eye. So you can never be sure about anything.
Right. That there's all physics depends on like these minute little details and measuring things to their purest degree so that you can determine what's going to happen in the future. And the Heisenberg principle is that you just can't do that. That as you're measuring one thing, another thing becomes grayer because you're measuring this one. So the way to think about it is like if you're clocking how fast a race car is going with a stopwatch, you have to look to the watch and to them. And the minute your eyes move, you're actually making the measurement less accurate. But he calls himself Heisenberg. I'm sure that this is on purpose, but it was still something really fascinating.
I love Vince Gilligan around the table in season 4. Someone go like, you know, there's a Werner Heisenberg.
But so he's a chemist who's everything is dependent on it being measured to the absolute nth degree where you.
He also works at Los Alamos at the beginning of the show, like in the backstory. And Heisenberg was integral in developing in the Manhattan Project.
Right. Yeah. When he's making meth, regardless of what he's doing, it's super imperative to him that everything is measured out perfectly and that everything, that there's a cause and effect to everything that you do. And as he's thinking up these plans as he goes, you notice throughout the show that there are, regardless of how much he thinks about, there's always like one element that he left out. And then that's what ends up coming back and becoming like the new problem of the next few episodes. That's the real pain of the series is that you're watching it and you're like, all right, they got it solved. Oh, but there was this one loose end that they didn't think
knowing
about.
All the time that the show wants you to think of him as the smartest man in the show, for sure. Like, if anyone was going to figure it out, he was.
Right, and but there's always this, regardless of what they do, there's this one loose end. There's the fly in the room somehow. Mm-hmm. And, like, that ends up becoming this huge, huge problem throughout the entire series. And so it's ironic that he would name himself Heisenberg and really kind of cool that they would choose to do that.
Instead of fly in the ointment, I think we should start saying kid on a bicycle. He was a real kid on a bicycle.
Because, he's also somebody who thinks that he can, that, like, he ethically, morally, that he can solve every problem there is and think it totally through.
But, yeah, I never got the Heisenberg tie-in is great metaphor. I mean, as far as, because that's how he lives his life, too, right? Thinking, if I measure all the elements in play precisely enough, I'll come out on top. Another reason I think the end is kind of a letdown, because he does come out on top, which violates the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
So, all right, my theory on the end, which I'm not going to be able to tie into quantum physics, but my theory is that Cranston fell too much in love with the character, and Gilligan and Cranston were like the two most powerful people on the show, but Cranston kind of won out, and so Gilligan didn't tell Cranston that everything after he's in the car, the cops are closing in, and he just closes his eyes, everything after that is happening inside his head.
Inside his head, or he died of cancer in that moment?
Maybe he died of cancer in that
moment.
But
whatever, it's like a Brazil, like the rest is a fantasy.
Yeah. Everything works exactly. Like he had just witnessed those people on TV, isn't that right?
Yeah.
And so he goes out, gets in the car, the police arrive, and everything from there on out, he like goes, gets those people back, everything works perfectly.
That's his Hail Bob comment.
Right.
He's on it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's arguably the most circuitous and possible like it relies upon a mechanized machine gun being properly placed and stuff. And it is exactly kind of the Rube Goldberg device that you'd be like, yeah, I like that. In his mind, he knows I might be dying in this car in the snow right here, but if I lived, I would have thought of some great plan. And it would have won everything.
See, I didn't know. You're talking about the time when he finds the keys.
Yes.
Oh, so he's in that car. He's locked in it. And it's snowing all around
him.
And
the cops are coming.
Sits there.
Because there's a pretty poignant moment where he like just looks defeated and sad in the cold. And then he's like, no, I'm going to rally. And I find the keys and it's all fine.
He just makes keys appear on the visor out of like sheer tyranny of will. Like, that's not how the
world
works.
Is it not his car?
No.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it seems extra fantastical that at the key moment.
The keys
fall out of the visor,
Yeah.
Well, it can tie in because there's an alternate parallel universe where He's Jesse.
What?
We're just Doc Brown.
Where they're both bartenders and they impregnate each other.
Did you know in the original version of Back to the Future, the script, that rather than having lightning strike that they use to send the car back to the future at the end of the movie, they use the first testing of the atomic bomb at Los Alamos?
I did not know that.
Isn't that fucking insane?
That's funny because it almost implies that had to happen. Or like the reason we tested the atomic bombs and bombed Nagasaki and Hiroshima was so that that kid could have time travel work
right.
in his little story.
Yeah.
Wait, they just utilize it because they know it's happening?
Or
they
actually do it?
Because they know it's going to happen and it's an immense source.
But they don't orchestrate
the plutonium thing.
I would love Doc appearing and be like, I know what we got to do. Start a war between Germany and America, well, so they have to create atomic weapons.
They plan on only doing one bombing, but they missed Hiroshima. So they had to go to Nagasaki and be like, all right, we'll do it again.
There's like a scene in the script where they like cut through the fence at Los Alamos.
Oh, boy.
Thank God they came up with the lightning thing, which lightning was the cure-all in the 80s. I talked about it on last week's podcast. They're just like, the robot that is a remote control robot up to this point gets struck by lightning. Now it has sentience.
Same with superpowers, man. Every superpower was just, there was a golden age where it could just be, all right, what is he? He's super speed? Okay, Quicksilver, and he gets struck by lightning.
Oh, no, it was either that or chemicals.
Right, but a combination. It was he's in some chemical and lightning strikes.
Yeah.
There was a great horror movie where a criminal being transported, Jack Frost, not the kids comedy, but the one where a murderer being transported is doused in nuclear waste, and then I think lightning strikes, and he becomes a snowman murderer.
That's so stupid.
Because it's snowing.
I'm glad that's not what happened to the guy who got doused in nuclear waste in RoboCop.
Why do we love lightning so much? Was that Frankenstein that started that? The Frankenstein movie?
It's just a mysterious thing with a lot of energy.
You definitely got something there, though, with the Frankenstein trope. It gives life, and it is mysterious power from the sky.
But back when Frankenstein was written, that was one of their main sources of electricity.
That's the Mary Shelley one. I don't think they use electricity.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. He just fucks him into
it. I'm sorry. Brett just brought up the Wikipedia page. In Jack Frost, I just have to note, the murderer then terrorizes the sleepy community of Snowmontown. The sentient snowman.
That's somebody pitching in the room and somebody who's like really insistent that they come up with a name for the town. He's like, I don't fucking know. It's fucking Snowmontown.
Snowmontown.
That is unbelievable. Did you guys ever watch Carnival?
No.
Whoa. Wait.
We're just going to talk about Jack.
Back down.
This is the quantum universe where the wave collapsed and we're just talking about Jack Frost
part of the plot is Paul Davreau, the sheriff's friend, witnesses the murder, but no one believes him. And then it says later, Billy's older sister Jill and her boyfriend sneak into the sheriff's home to steal his wine and have sex as payback for their brother's death.
That's we'll how you show pay him. People back in Snowmontown.
drink his wine and bone.
But anyway, Carnival was this HBO show, short-lived, takes place in the Dust Bowl, and it had a really intriguing central premise where basically the creation of the atomic bomb is the barrier between an age of magic and our current day age of science. That is a really significant thing if you buy into all the things we're talking about and sort of the fact that everything starts at this like tiny quantum level and we turned this tiny quantum reaction into a thing that just killed like a large chunk of the population at once.
Not only killed them, turned them into shadows.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's magic.
Yeah, once science was able to do magic was just like, ah.
But you win.
Fuck. We're going to go off to England for a little while.
Well, that's what's so hilarious to me about the constant fictional war between magic and science is magic, by definition, is beholden to nothing. Yet almost every magic system is more restrictive than what science can do. Like we've often pointed out that Voldemort's army could be beaten with any number of technical means. I'm wondering why there's not inflation in our fantasy novels. Like at this point, a wizard should shoot nuclear weapons, right? Because this wizard is existing in a fictional or in a world where the readers are aware of nuclear weapons. I feel like we should up the ante.
That is weird.
Like Daenerys should have more powers.
Well, we're even insistent on wands still being little pieces of stick wood, like little dowels.
Well, but we're not insistent on that. The universe is, and
all the
it makes sense.
Magic.
Like if the magic was so fragile that you had to like say a bunch of weird, stupid words to exercise your powers, you would want to be in hiding because science would just be like, ah, get him. Yeah. Fucking
but it's like,
kill him.
And I understand the storyteller's perspective because you're thinking, I mean, Gandalf's a good example because he's pretty darn powerful, but then there's times where his power is semi-arbitrarily limited because it would break the story, right, if Superman can just save everyone. But that's kind of what science is like.
Right.
So it's just funny to me that your wizard in your average story, I'm pretty sure I could take him out with like a, you know, an RPG, shoulder-mounted RPG.
Right. There's always a scene in a wizard movie where like a lot of things are being thrown at them and they're like,
but they're all just lights.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
all just lightning
and
bolts.
They just like stop them with their hands and like push them back. But yeah, like a magazine of a machine gun just flying at you from...
Or better yet, a nuclear weapon launched from space. Deal with that, wizard.
Or 100 nuclear
weapons. Well, warriors. Yeah, it's they're beholden to how fast their hand can move. Like, at that point, you watch them... They have to move their hand to, like, stop each one of those bullets and stuff. It's not like Neo in the Matrix where they just... All of a sudden, all the machine gun bullets can just all stop at once. You watch them. Like, they physically have to make a motion.
Yeah.
You can't make a motion over and over in the amount of time that a magazine from a machine gun would fire at you.
Which is why we should clearly just hook all our nuclear weapon systems up to a computer and let it handle it. Let the guys who made Farmville hack something out.
Yeah.
Like a net full, but just for like the weapons that are in the sky, yeah. Like a satellite, just
like a sky,
I don't know. Satellite.
Oh, you want to wait
a sky net?
Guys, we just brought it back to Dave Matthews Band.
Well done. Correction, you brought it back to Dave Matthews Band.
Why did I mention
As you do every episode,
place.
Brett just cuts it out usually.
How I wonder.
Well, you know, it's the thing about teleportation is the space between.
It would be fun to go through every Dave Matthews song and figure out the quantum physics equivalent. Like, show your world, like, hike up your skirt a little more, show your world to me, like, where that fits into quantum physics. Like, technically, there is an entire world that could exist up there above a skirt if you think of it.
That guy was so horny when he wrote that.
All right. Honestly, I can't believe we found another Back to the Future theory. That movie is an infinite puzzle of possibilities, like the infinite universe model of quantum physics. To catch you up, if you didn't listen to our episode live in Nashville, we've discussed the idea that in the climax of Back to the Future, when Marty has arrived back to the future, and he's running to the mall to save Doc, he arrives too late, just in time to see Doc get shot and himself go back in time. And then he wakes up the next morning and his parents are rich and he has that awesome car that he always wanted. And we pointed out that, so that version of Marty that he saw go back in time is completely different than the one we've known in the movie. That Marty that we saw go back in time at the Lone Pines Mall at the end of the movie, that Marty watched go back in time when he was watching himself, that kid grew up with rich parents. He got the car he wanted right away. And he's probably kind of a dick. And we thought about what that meant for that version of Doc, who was wearing a bulletproof vest because he knew Marty in the 50s. And we tried to piece together like that Doc's timeline and what his life must have been like. And how that Doc had known that he had to befriend this 16-year-old kid and get him to do all these things exactly in this way ever since Marty was born to rich, hot shit parents. So like that Doc probably had to like watch Marty grow up through binoculars and had to befriend him in a way that felt natural and not creepy. And who the hell knows how Doc and Marty originally met organically? Like, I don't think Marty ever explained that to Doc in the 50s. So must have been some weird accident since teenagers don't generally hang out with elderly gentleman. And this Doc had to force that meeting and then convince that kid to recreate all the different parts of that shootout and panic joyride resulting in trip back in time. And we came to the conclusion that it must have taken thousands, if not millions, of tries to get it to go exactly right, which I guess is a luxury you're afforded when you have a time machine. You can just kind of loop back and try over and over again, just grab a new Marty. And that the car that Marty sees himself go back in could not have actually been a time machine, because if rich Marty went back in time, he could have just screwed everything up. He could have made everyone start disappearing like a Polaroid developing in reverse, like we see in the movie. So when Marty watches himself go back in time, he's actually watching a rich alternate version of himself explode. Doc Brown had a time machine DeLorean that he was traveling back in time with repeatedly, but the one we see Marty drive was probably just rigged with dynamite or something because they couldn't risk letting Rich Marty go back. Rich kids have irresponsible sex with girls and expect things to just work out. Rich Marty can't be trusted in his horny mom's bedroom. So our theory was that the final scene when Marty sees himself go back in time must have been like the Nolan movie The Prestige, except instead of thousands of drowned Hugh Jackmans, there are thousands of exploded, disintegrated Rich Martys blowing around the parking lot of the Lone Pines Mall across millions of alternate universes. That's the other theory. I like this one better. Doc is old Marty. It's a closed loop. Well done, Soren, I think his name was. All right, that's enough of that. On to footnotes. We listened to Easy Rider by Action Bronson, which is off Jensen Karp, host of Wolf Pop's Get Up On This. Just got up on Spotify and put his favorite songs of 2014 up, and this was one I'd missed. And now love Action Bronson, if you don't know him, is a loose pants wearing foodie rapper from New York who sounds a lot like Ghostface at first, but he gets more particular and interesting the more you listen to him. And I don't know, I'm now officially a fan. This is, I think, the title track off his most recent album, Maybe, and in it, he claims to have buried $1 million in the sand next to the clock tower, which Rap Genius claims is a reference to the sands of an hourglass, but I prefer to think he robbed a bank in the past and Back to the Future, then got the money, buried it, which is a poorly planned risk-reward due to inflation, but sounds like something that would happen in that trilogy. We listened to Inside Out by Spoon from the recent Spoon album called They Want My Soul, on the cover of which a woman's hand holds a suspended ball of light, which is something that they can do now. Scientists, they can just stop light with a woman's hand. And a spoon, I don't know. This was one of my favorite albums last year, and it's a great, pretty song, and it starts and repeats the line, "Time's gone inside out," which felt appropriate for today's episode. We heard What That Was from Magical Clouds, which is one of my favorite musicians' bands. I don't know, it's like a guy and then his producer. But their music always felt a little low energy for what we do on this podcast. But I love this song, which didn't appear on their first album, so I wanted to make sure you guys heard it. They're called Magical Clouds, which, again, felt appropriate with all the talk of clouds of probability and how indistinguishable quantum physics is from magic. They spell both those words, by the way, in terrible ways. Magical with a J, clouds with a Z, I know. But I don't know, the guy just sings in such an earnest way that it feels like you're sharing memories with him. Anyways, we're gonna ride out on that one. Back next week with more podcasts. guys still here? That was my Ferris Bueller ref. Hey guys, do something good for yourself in 2015 and sign up for a free 10-day trial to lynda.com by visiting lynda.com/cracked. Go ahead. I challenge you to learn something new in 2015.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. The wolf dead.